everyone. Welcome to another episode of Just Press Start at justpressstart.net. I have with me tonight the creative and artistic director, Matt Kanai, from the game Hanako, Honor and Blade. Matt, thank you so much for joining us this evening, and why don't you introduce yourself, even though I just kind of did, and tell us a little bit about Hanako.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks a lot for having me on. Like Jeff said, I'm Matt. I'm a creative and art director on Hanako, Honor and Blade. We've been working on this, believe it or not, for 8 years, going on 9. The game started as a college project way back at SCAD Atlanta in 2007, 2008-ish. And then we worked on it throughout all of college. And then back in the summer of 2013, we got the itch and decided, hey, let's finish what we started. And we kind of started over from scratch. So that's kind of what we've been working on. I mean, it's kind of crazy because I'm a AAA game developer during the day at Hi-Rez Studios, and it's an amazing undertaking to try to do that on top of making an indie game on the side. But, you know, the purpose of the game and the backstory of the game and how it all came to be, it's kind of the driving force, and it kind of keeps us all going.
Well, I was going to say that, too, that not only is it a dream project for you, it's also a deeply personal project as well. So I was hoping you could go into a little more detail about that.
Oh, sure. So pretty much like my entire high school life, my mom was sick going through cancer treatment. And it was just like, hey, teenager that should be having fun, welcome to the real world. You need to be a caretaker and grow up really fast. So at the end of my first year of college, she unfortunately passed away, and I was studying game development. And over my winter break that year in 2007, because she passed in October, I just started writing. And I had a game idea from when I was younger. I always wanted to make a samurai game. Last Samurai is my favorite movie ever, and Japanese culture and martial arts has always spoken to me deeply. So the idea came to me, like, I want to make a game that tells her story. It tells how difficult it is struggling and staring death in the face every day and dealing with the terminal illness every day and using feudal Japanese warfare as kind of a metaphor for it all, and having kind of these two opposing clans that one embodies her and everything she stands for. She was an extremely loving person. She had a love of nature and things like that, and have a clan that embodies the opposite. It embodies death and disease and decay and the brutality of war, and kind of weaving this feudal Japanese story into a really personal, a way for me to kind of give myself closure, even though it's going on 10 years and I still don't feel that, but it's a way for me to kind of, it was the only way I got through it, really, going back to the early days. It was, you know, you're staring grief in the face every day, and I think when you're an artist or a creative person, the best thing you can do is put all of that emotion into your work. So with the team that we had, you know, of course, not everyone on the team has gone through something like that. So it just kind of evolved over many years and became this huge dream project for everyone for different reasons and different motivations. But the team's really rallied behind the idea and the design. And it's been a tremendous honor to lead all of them for so long. And the crazy thing is there's team members that have worked for 3 years I've never met in person. They messaged us from like a LinkedIn or a PolyCount or some forum somewhere and said, hey, this game looks awesome, I want to work on this. And you chat a little bit and they start working on it. And it's really flattering for someone you've never met to put years of their life into your dream and to embrace that as their own and say, hey, I think we can make something of this. So it's kind of expanded and extrapolated from there into this thing that, you know, it's huge to us. We're still little guys in the big scheme of things. I mean, I'm sure you've talked to indie developers before that talk about how difficult marketing and getting the word out to press. And yeah, the analogy I always make is like, it's the press is almost like the hot girl at the bar that gets hit on 100 times a day. You know, she's just so used to every trick in the book being thrown at her that nothing truly stands out. So it's rough waters for an indie game to kind of get the word out. So it's always a great privilege to talk to you and talk to people running gaming websites and getting the news out, and they're willing to take time to support indie games.
Well, I mean, it's definitely important to me, and this your story. I mean, it's made me almost speechless. But what I want to ask you about the game and transforming that vision into a game, in wanting to tell such a personal story, I'm curious why you went with a multiplayer type game rather than a single player, more of a story-driven experience kind of thing. I'm just, talk me through that decision-making process.
So we always felt like in school that the resources required to do single player is so much more significant. Just the people that you need and the money that you need even to be able to do, not necessarily like full cinematics or anything, though I feel like that's kind of necessity in modern single player games. But there's other ways to do it. It just came down to kind of a resource thing. It's like we have a 10-person team. What do we think we can accomplish? We had this giant 70-page design document that when we were overzealous college students, we wanted to follow every single thing. We're just like, oh, we gotta have this, we gotta have horse mounts, and we gotta have like fully customizable everything, and every class can be like 20 things. And they were like, all right, let's slow it down for a little bit. We're not gonna ship with like 10 classes. Let's do the three like standard melee classes. We'll do an archer class and let's just do that. And then if we have time, we can revisit the rest. So the long-term goal is, so our studio is called Impact Games, and there's a plus sign at the beginning, and it's a little on the head. I was 20, when we came up with that name.
Right.
But we want our games to inspire people to pursue their own dreams or to better themselves as people. I mean, I still remember playing Shenmue 2 when I was 14 and the impact that it had on me. That game I attribute getting into game development and seeking out martial arts again and getting into like wholesome things. And I've never been so inspired by like a single piece of media. So I kind of took that feeling and applied, like, that's my life goal. I have to make games that people play and they can take something that important and transform themselves based off of their experience. So we see multiplayer as kind of a stepping stone to getting into that kind of thing. So hopefully Hanako Honor and Blade can get us the resources that we need to foray into single player. We kind of have a rough plan that it's reasonable nowadays to do an episodic kind of thing where we don't have to make like a 80-hour game in a single development cycle and work on it for 4 years with 100 people. It's like, no, we can make like 2 really awesome hours of gameplay. We can release that, and then that kind of pays for the next 2 hours. Then we just kind of keep building the story and kind of center each episode around applicable life themes. So like I said, loss, everyone unfortunately is gonna have to deal with loss in their lives. So exploring that through a game story and kind of developing the characters in a way that it can kind of teach people indirectly without being preachy that, hey, there's ways you can get through these things, just as a kind of a rough example. So multiplayer, we're not as story driven. I'd love to be, but we have to tell the story as best as we can through the art and the environments, and kind of our campaign system that we built around the game is kind of our story, if you will. And I can go into more detail if you'd like
Absolutely, yes.
on how that works. So basically, the environments are really what's there. Every environment and every scene you play is kind of symbolic of something personal. So basically, you're starting in the center of Japan, and in our we kind of wove an actual lore into the game world too. And basically, in our story, it's during the Sengoku era, which in actual historic Japanese history, it's when all the warring clans periods, when there's 50 clans warring for supremacy, and the Oda clan and Nobunaga rises up and all that. We kind of rewrote the script to suit our game to be there's the Yamai clan. They're the antagonists of the game, kind of wiped out all the clans, and except for this one clan that's secluded in Mount Yari in a hidden mountain village. No one really even knows they exist. They keep to themselves. Only the emperor knows of their existence. And they're going to siege Kyoto and try to kill the emperor and stake claim to the throne. But the emperor has two sons that he sends off to live with the Hanako clan to be under their protection. And so when they kill the emperor, there's still heirs to the throne, so they can't fully claim it. And then the capital eventually moves. So the player starts essentially a war where the Yamai clan, they're marching from Kyoto to Mount Yari, and they end up in the center of Japan in an area called Gifu. And basically, we have a tug of war campaign map cycle system. Instead of just, a lot of game, multiplayer games, you play a map, and then you play another map, and then you play whatever. And there's no, real, they're not stitched together in any way necessarily. Not that this has never been done before, it probably has, but anyway, depending on which clan wins, it determines which map you play next. And there's a kind of a linear progression where you're trying to fight to the opposing clan's castle to kill their daimyo, which is the leader of their clan.
Right.
And each map is a different game mode. So you kind of start in a traditional kind of team deathmatch. We've talked about doing three-way team deathmatch where you have kind of a Ronin ninja team that can just kill anyone. They can't win the match, but they're just kind of there. It'd be a good team for trolls. But we've kept it to two teams for now. And then, so artistically, the map looks very neutral. You can't really see too many influences of either clan. It just looks like, oh, it's just kind of a Japanese environment. And as you push closer to one of the clans on the polar ends, you see more and more of their influence. You start to learn the kind of the character traits of the clans. So as you get closer to Hanako territory, you're getting closer to the mountains, you're seeing more snow and more nature. And because the clan embodies my mother and some mentors that I've lost along the process of the game too, you see little tributes to them, and there's cherry blossoms anywhere they exist in the game, or kind of a little nod to her. And coincidentally, they're also the areas where you heal in the game. You can meditate under any sakura with falling petals and heal. So there's kind of gameplay tie-ins too. So you get this gradation where you're starting kind of in this neutral area, and then you're getting into this very beautiful, natural, serene, peaceful mountain landscapes with falling snow and beautiful architecture. And you can tell the Hanako clan what they stand for, and you kind of get that undertone a little bit without us, being like, hey, this means that. The player isn't necessarily going to know that it's a personal story unless they really dig deep and research the game.
Right.
But the point is that they understand what the clans stand for in some sense. They'll look at this clan like, oh wow, these guys are honorable. They stand for something that matters. And then on the flip side, you get into Yamai territories and southwest Japan. You start seeing the brutality of war. You start seeing like the on-fire buildings and bodies laying around, and the color palette's completely different. It's much more neutral and ugly greens, just colors that are uneasy. You feel uneasy playing the levels. You don't feel safe. We kind of want a little bit of a paranoia on those levels where you don't feel secure, because that's when you're sick, that's how you feel. You don't know what the next day holds or if there is a next day. So it's, for me, it's therapeutic to work on both sides because I have to face what took her artistically. But I also get to honor her too. So it's kind of facing all sides of the coin for better or worse. And it's helped me grow as a person a lot, and the team too. Some of the team members have kind of embraced that part of the game more than others. Others, some of the team, they just love samurai. It's hard to dispute a good samurai ninja experience. There's not a whole lot of them.
So, what artists influenced the look of the game? Do you have specific, specific styles that you were considering when you? Because I mean, that was the other thing. Besides the personal nature of the story, I was immediately taken by just how gorgeous the backdrops were in the screenshots that you had sent me. So again, what, who or what influenced how you wanted this to look when you were telling these stories?
Well, I think for a lot of the project, it's been kind of dictated by what the skill level of the artists are.
Okay.
When we were in college, it was really limited to college level art, which isn't necessarily bad, but there's a huge gap between like professional and college and indie in most cases. So it was kind of like, what can we do that's reasonable and doesn't take, years and years and years to build like every prop and every building. But then, we took 3 years off after college, roughly, and I was an environment artist for a number of years professionally and learned so much from so many different mentors that it was like, all right, now we can do the art style we wanted the whole time. And that's kind of inspired by traditional Japanese painting. It's that sumi ink style, the Japanese landscape paintings on scrolls and the kind of the walls. You see those door panels, the really beautiful door panels that they have in like feudal Japanese
Right.
castles, that the sliding doors that have like the gold embossed kind of floral work. And that was really the biggest influence, was kind of paying tribute to traditional Japanese art. And also at the time when the game started, Okami was super huge. When back in like 2007, it was still
Okay.
pretty popular. I don't remember exactly when Okami came out now, but that was kind of, we didn't want to go that stylized, but there was something really awesome about that art style. And at the time, there weren't a lot of like super art games getting made. It was still kind of, you had that AAA look on a lot of things. I think Unreal Engine 3 was like in its infancy, so that like high spec glossy everything kind of look was really popular then. So seeing something like Okami was like, oh wow, this looks amazing. And then Borderlands a few years later, which is one of my favorite games. So we looked at what do we think is reasonable. I do most of the environment art. So it's kind of like, what can I do reasonably where people aren't waiting on the work all the time? The rest of my team isn't waiting, like, hey, where's the crate so I can make stacks so ninjas can run up buildings? Sorry, like, I got to paint the wood for 5 days or whatever. So we kind of chose, like, if you put Okami on one end of a spectrum and like Call of Duty on the other, we wanted to hit, maybe 33% from the middle, kind of in between the
Right.
middle and Okami. We get compared to Borderlands an awful lot in terms of that, our art style. So I'd say that's, that's fair. That's a good comparison. It's an honor to be compared to a giant AAA game ever. The four honor ones are starting to roll in a little bit. So
So,
that's kind of the influence there.
now, when you settled on, when, not settled on, when you decided on an art style, how do you then also decide what the experience is going to be like, musically, sound effects wise? How do you determine, how do you score a game like this? You said you had a funny story about the London Symphony Orchestra, so I thought maybe we could try and tie that in.
Yes, good tie-in. We knew we want, like I mentioned before, we had to, we can't tell a story outright. We can't
Right.
have cinematics and all of that in a multi, I mean, I guess you could, but for our purposes, we decided it's just not something reasonable for us to do. So the environments were kind of the main way of telling the story. And then music, which to me is the most emotional art form. I think people connect to music emotionally and apply it to things they've gone through in their lives, probably more than any other art form I can think of. Everyone had people's like favorite song. Usually it's because they tie some memory to it, like nostalgia or whatever. So we were introduced to a composer that was working on his master's. He was at Berkeley and they had a campus in Spain. Super talented guy. He immediately jumped on board. He's been with us the whole project. Since we restarted in 2013. And he started working on the score. And the main thing was, so we designed a music system that you have your, there's a default music track for every level that has a very specific mood. There's it, the whole purpose of it is we're setting the mood for what this level stands for symbolically. So we might want a super emotional piece that if you're just running around the level, not fighting, you kind of feel the purpose of the level. So like for example, if you're in like the Hanako mountains and you're running around not fighting and you're under a cherry blossom, you want peaceful, serene, kind of triumphant music. And I'll have to send you a link to his SoundCloud and let you listen to some of it. And actually, I'm going to give you a Steam key at the end of this chat so you can check it out yourself and join us for tests if you'd like.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
We test every Wednesday at 10, so Eastern. If anytime you want to join us, we'll send you the details. We'd love to have you join us.
Cool.
It's much more fun than running around with bots or seeing screenshots. I hope. I hope. It might not be. You might be like, it sucks. This is the worst thing ever. But so we have that, and then we have, he starts layering in percussion. when you see any enemy from any distance. If you see a bad guy, you start getting some, it starts amping the music up a little bit. And then it, when you're fighting, it's full combat music, kind of get you in the zone of combat, and it's a completely different track, but it's still the same kind of melodies and chord progression, so it still ties in with the original. So when you first started, of course, we needed a title track. We were working on, kind of launch videos and trying to get the word out there, even though it was pretty early in the process. And he had told us that for his master's thesis project, everyone in his class is getting to go to Air Studios in London and record their master's thesis project. And that project is to seek out a film or game outside of the school and score a title track for it.
Oh, wow.
So we got super lucky there. So he composed the track and flew to London to record it with the 52 piece, I think it was, 52 piece orchestra. And he explained to me the talent. I was blown away. He said, you hand them all sheet music, they record it single take. They don't
Wow.
even rehearse. They're just like, bam, perfect. And what he told me is the day that they went, the studio had been double booked. And he told me it was double booked with them and Hans Zimmer. And
Wow.
I would say that Hans Zimmer is the biggest influence I could ever. And like Last Samurai soundtrack, that's totally, if I could pick a single influence for the soundtrack, I love that soundtrack. I love Hans Zimmer. All of his, he's the best composer in film, in my opinion. Of course, John Williams too, but, and I didn't believe him. Like, dude, there's no way Hans Zimmer was there. He's like, no, I promise. He was really upset, and then he kind of walked into the room, like the orchestra, and to see like who on earth is double booked over me, because he's super famous. And then he heard them recording student work, and he walked up to the students and asked like what they're doing. And he actually took the time like listen to their pieces and give them feedback and hang out with them for a little while. And he came away super impressed with all their work.
Oh, wow.
And they actually like, got to meet him. And then he got his track mastered after the fact, and we have this awesome London Air like symphony orchestral title track, and we completely lucked out on it by chance.
That's serendipity, right? I mean, that's the very definition of serendipity. That's incredible. Wow.
And I'm still not sure if I even believe that story, but I have no reason to doubt our composer. He wouldn't just make up some brash, like crazy out there story. So, I mean, we like to tell that story. It's an awesome, we've had some really interesting coincidences over the course of the project that really make you question like higher powers in the universal cosmos and all that. It gets a little kooky sometimes with stuff happens, you're like, whoa, that's unbelievable.
Well, again, sometimes when something is meant to be, it is meant to be. So it's one of those accept it and just be grateful kind of. Wow, that's incredible. So in terms of gameplay, what is your design theory in terms of accessibility versus challenge? Are you catering more towards people? What type of gamer do you want to play Hanako at the end of the day?
We want every type of gamer, all of them, just every gamer that exists, come on and play, except the really mouthy Call of Duty headset bros. They can stay there. But no, if they want to buy our game, anyone can play. I hope we can have a good community, but there's going to be crap talking in any game ever. I would say it's kind of in between. What we've been saying the whole time is we want it to be easy to pick up but difficult to master. Kind of an easy learning curve but a high skill ceiling. So the main design goal overall is we want a melee game that is not hack and slash. The Dynasty Warriors like press A and then you have 1,000 kills in a minute. And we also don't want like a slow, clunky gesture system like a Chivalry or a Mountain Blade where it's a cool gesture system, but it's so slow, and the pacing is deliberate because you have to be able to react to those kind of attacks. So we're trying to split the gap a little bit there between those two styles of melee games. I would say Jedi Knight series is probably the closest thing I could point to is like, if I had to pick an influence for like a combat system, it kind of Jedi Academy, Jedi Knight, it's a directional based system where your player moves dictates where the attack goes. So if you're strafing to the left, your attack goes to the left. If you're moving forward, you swing overhead. You know, if you're moving back, you stab, and you kind of have a separate stab button that has different functionality. Eventually, we'll evolve it. You can, you know, stab a downed opponent. And then we decided this, it wasn't in the original design, but when we revisited everything, we decided to also add abilities. And I would say they're kind of MOBA style in nature, a little action RPG. We're working on a skill tree kind of talent system where you're picking between like stat boosts, pure like plus 50 health, like talents where you get like a double jump or a dodge or, you know, something like that, some gameplay mechanic that's appended to your skill set, and just pure abilities, combos and charges and dashes. And we kind of want players to build towards each class eventually. I don't think we're going to have this fully in early access. I think we're just going to do two branches that go to one master box. We want you to progress through your character through a match or a campaign towards mastering your class. So you start as kind of a novice swordsman. We want you to be a master swordsman by the end and do some cosmetic changes, you know, a different helmet or a different armor, something that signifies that you achieved this awesome master box, and then you get a master, kind of an ultimate, if you will. We're calling them master combos or master moves. So, and that's kind of mixing in just an additional level. So our basic combat is based on movement, and these are more, you know, what you'd expect of an action RPG, where you're pressing one, two, or three, and you're firing off kind of a pre-made combo where the character kind of moves, the animation drives the movement. Or, you know, we just did our first combination one where you press your ultimate, you do this like draw attack that stuns everyone, and then if you hit the attack again, and if while it's flashing, you get this crazy combo that you can move freely during, and you kind of do like these six slashes, and it makes them bleed. And it's right now we got lucky with the initial numbers. Most characters, if you get all six, the last tick of bleed kills them rather than the slash. You get that like Kung Fu movie delay where you're like, and then they plop dead, and it's kind of satisfying. So we want, you know, we kind of want players to be able to use both. Abilities aren't the emphasis per se, but we just wanted something more fun and basic combat. We didn't feel like we had the resources to really build like a full out like fighting game combo system where there's kind of like input delay, like a street it's waiting for you to press like the eight keys to do the combo.
And
We
it
just
sounds
you
like you wanted to avoid the Bushido Blade, you know, one hit kills as well.
Yes. It's kind of a rock, paper, scissors with our classes. We kind of have our you have your tank that's, you know, slower moving, kind of medium range. He's not as fast, but he has a lot of armor, and you want him on your front lines. You have your ninja, which of course is your glass cannon, like DPS rogue class, that he's dashing around and flipping around and grappling the things, and he's dishing out damage, but if you can catch him at all, he's done. Kind of have your balance class, the swordsman, who's just kind of right in the middle. He can hold his own against anyone. He's kind of based on the skill of the player. He just kind of balances out the two. And of course the archer is kind of a wild card because he has the range ability, but he's kind of a glass cannon too. He's limited in his kiting abilities. If you catch him, he's screwed. But he's the only character that can shoot range besides ninja, has some poison darts and ninja stars and things like that.
And those glass cannons can also take advantage of some of the environmental effects as well, correct?
Yes, the kind of all the classes have some base movement things that are a little different. The ninja is unique, and basically, so you have two stances. You have kind of a light stance and a heavy stance. And the light stance, you can move freely while you're attacking, and the medium stance actually is animation-driven attacks. So they're heavier, but your plant steps and your movement's actually driven by the attack. So you just kind of execute the one you want to do, and then usually you also have a right click, which is like a block or parry for most characters. But the ninja switches to a grapple mode. So when you're in your kind of, instead of blocking, you lose your block ability, but you can grapple instead. And you can also grapple players with that. So it's particularly powerful for a built-in class ability. But it's on a cooldown. It takes spirit. We kind of have it's called ki in our game, but it's kind of a mana mechanic. Not as traditional as like you have 2,000 mana. It's probably closer to like an energy where it's a lower value and it drains a little bit faster. It's used by a lot of different things. Sprint uses it and abilities use it. So there's kind of an additional resource management there. So you can't just sprint across a map, fire all your abilities, and just keep firing everything. You kind of have to manage your kit, because we want you to really focus on the basic combat and the skill there of planning your attacks and your directions and the abilities there to supplement or to finish off kills, really.
And to look cool doing it.
Yeah, they need a spice. The basic attacks, some people, expect a 4 honor level of polish and crazy attacks just from your basics, but we do what we can. We just want fun directional attacks, and hopefully abilities can take care of the cool factors. And in our design down the road, we want to do kind of a kill shot kind of setup where the game kind of detects when your attack's going to kill them, and it goes to kind of like a pre-made like fatality, if you will.
Okay.
That would be our term, of course, but something similar to that where you kind of get a custom camera, and the Kenji, for instance, would have like a decapitation, since he's a swordsman, and the archer would like shoot an arrow through your throat and pin you to a wall. Just like the really cool finishing moves that you want to be streaming on Twitch when you do them, kind of thing.
Exactly.
Like, oh my God, I shot two an arrow through two throats and killed got a double kill. That was amazing. I'm not confirming we're doing that. I don't want people like posting on Reddit in a year like, I didn't get the double throat shot. Impact Games makes up lies. You promise worse than like Stephen Molyneux for Fable.
We have to watch out for that. So
Full disclosure, I make no promises. We will do our very best as developers, but we are 10 guys with no money and we all have day jobs. So maybe 4 hours a day at the most we can put in. Sometimes more. I'm the crackhead that's staying up till like, putting 8 hours in at work and then 8 hours at home kind of schedule. But when it's your project, you do what you got to do.
And now you also said you're toying with the idea of a third team that can be, it's kind of like a rogue team that can be freelancers, as it were.
Yes, I'd still love to do that. The team's not as fond of it as I am, so
Okay.
there's some compromise there. They don't, and part of it too is we used to have a Ronin class that we were going to ship with, so it would have made sense. You would have kind of like Kenshi, which is our swordsman, our pikemen, and our archers, kind of the samurai classes, and then the ninja and Ronin would be outliers on their own team, so you
Okay.
wouldn't just have. And it was just kind of a scope thing. It was like, we're not going to ship with the Ronin right away. We do want to release him later. We do have 4 classes planned after full release, once we, hopefully have budget to keep going. So we have kind of our 4 release classes and then our expansion classes. So we felt like it'd be weird to have one class just for one team. So I kind of agree with my team on that. But the concept I like the idea. Because Team Deathmatch is just—it's kind of a boring game mode. You're fighting, and it's about the battle, and the maps are like just battlefields, like Last Samurai, Final Battle, Charge to the Middle kind of maps.
Right.
But it would definitely introduce a much more interesting element. And I think we'll probably find something to spice up the battle game mode anyway. If eventually, we'll absolutely test it. We got to at least try it once and be like, all right, ninjas just killing both sides while they're trying to kill each other is kind of awesome. Like, they can't win the match for anyone, but they're just in there interfering, and just maybe they take the winning kill from the other team and swing the game or something. It'd be interesting. We had all kind of crazy ideas early on. We were talking about you have the neutral team, but you can spend, instead of leveling your skill tree, you could spend XP to bid on a ninja to join your team. And basically the ninja could agree to your bid, and then they would get that XP. So you could kind of power level a ninja by getting them to join your team. We talked about some crazy stuff. I don't think we'll ever do that, but
That's a bar, because I happened to read about that on the site too, and I was like, "Oh, that's very intriguing." So it's cool that you're still considering it, but that it's not, not necessarily a, certainly not a, we're gonna do this right away type of mechanic either. So.
I don't think so. The 13 thing is easy, relatively easy. It's worth trying. We've been focusing on our other game modes. There's God, we went back and forth with like five or six different designs for this particular one. We call it Capture the Informant, and it's kind of our take on Capture the Flag. And basically the story of it, the purpose of the game mode is you are the CTI maps take place, and they're adjacent to the villages. So you're almost to pay dirt in a sense. You're almost to the enemy territory. You're knocking on the door, but you don't know exactly where that door is. So there's an informant on both teams that know the location. They have information pertinent to where the next battle has to take place. So instead of capturing a static flag, you need to knock out that informant who's a randomly selected player and drag him, like literally drag his ragdoll back to your camp. So we're working on knocking out the guy, and he ragdolls, and you grab his leg and drag him back to your camp. And meanwhile, the enemy team's trying to rescue him and kill you while you're dragging the guy. And you plop him in your camp, and you enter kind of an interrogation phase where you're holding him in your camp for a time limit, trying to extract the information. And if you hold him there and the enemy team's unable to rescue him, then you figured out where their village is, and then you push onto the next map.
Oh, cool.
So that's kind of our take. We thought it'd be more fun. Dragging a ragdoll is much more fun than a flag. So we think we don't we're starting really early tests on it, so it's hilarious. The ragdoll is really fun to just mess around, just put in a bot in our in the Unreal Editor and just drag him around is pretty fun. We don't penalize the player. The informant just respawns as like a generic character, like whatever class they want after. So they don't have to endure being dragged around.
Right.
It just turns into kind of a dead NPC. But I think that'll be fun. And then our village mode is pretty close to done. That's the screenshots that I sent you of that map. We're finishing up the art for. That's kind of a mixture of destructible objectives and capture point, and it kind of alternates. There's kind of a linear progression where it's kind of almost like a campaign within a campaign. The logic with the way it works, excuse me, is kind of the same. It's kind of a central objective, and depending on what team wins, it kind of determines which objective is the next active objective. It could be a capture point, could be a whatever. So there's kind of like key areas in the village, a temple and like horse stables and a forge that go vulnerable for periods of time, and you have to defend them for a time limit. And other teams trying to destroy, a central support beam or, some important supplies. And I spent a lot of time professionally doing like destructible stuff and like doing the tech for it. So wanted to be able to use those skills a little bit and do some destructibles and have, a temple crumble down after you destroy it.
So what's been something that has that came up to be a lot more easily than you thought it would, other than the score, obviously. And what was something that you thought was going to be simpler to implement that turned out to be more of a challenge than you were expecting?
The easiest thing.
If there has been, I mean, maybe none of it's been easy, you know.
I would say the ninja. What's we this whole like for at the time for 6 years we talked about how complicated the ninja was going to be to make, how hard grappling was going to be, and I think the team got so excited about it that we finished the ninja in like 2 months. Like the whole character was just done.
Oh, wow.
And just our animators went crazy and got, I mean, the just everyone got on a tear. Just everyone kind of clicked into the zone at the same time. And our programmer got like grappling working right away. And the animators got like, and the system's crazy because his weapon, have you seen videos of the ninja at all?
Not yet.
So his weapon, he has a Kusarigama, it's like a chained sickle. And he swings it around. The weapon is not attached to the character at all in the engine. It's completely freestanding, and basically it has they both play animations that are synchronized to each other. So when we animate the chain, the weapon, and the character, export them separately, and then they play in synonymy with each other in the engine. And it is that was super hard to figure out, but once we did, it was amazing how fast we got them done. So that was probably the easiest, which is weird because his design's so much more complicated than any of the other characters. And conversely, the hardest thing, there's been so many difficulties on the project. I would say for me personally, dealing with a failed Kickstarter. We did one last March, I think. Maybe the March before. I don't remember exactly when it was now. I think it, no, it was not last March. It was the March before. So in 2015, we did a Kickstarter. And we had all this stuff planned. We started in November of 2014 and did all this video work and we did all this research and had so many debates about like, should we have dev talks? Do dev interviews even work in Kickstarters or should it be just gameplay? Like, we thought it was cheesy to have like the devs talking about the game with like some dramatic background or whatever, which we ended up, I think, being wrong about it. And we had all these marketing things. We spent a lot of personal money on it and just everything fell flat. Absolutely everything. We released a demo because it was like, well, Kickstarters were kind of on the decline for games because, big high profile game Kickstarters weren't coming through with their promises. And so we put a demo out and it was kind of like an arcade style, like wave based, like, every you fight a guy one on one in this kind of alley map and each one gets a little bit harder and you try to see how many waves you can survive. And we had it, you could submit your score to Facebook and we put a lot of effort into that demo. I mean, the reality of it is the game wasn't ready for Kickstarter yet. And we thought it was. It was really, we had one class. He had his basic attacks. I think he had two abilities and it was just really early. It wasn't refined yet. Our animations weren't refined. So no one really even played the demo. We didn't get any like score submissions. We're going to try to do contests and hope that the game would kind of virally spread through people seeing scores getting shared and like, oh, what's this score thing, And we did a thunderclap, which is like a, have you heard of thunderclap?
I have not.
It's kind of like a Kickstarter in a sense, but you're contributing your like social network. Like
Okay.
you're pledging to tweet like whatever the campaign sets their message to. So the hope is you get like 1,000 people to sign up, and then at a certain date and time that you set, if you get enough people, all those people will tweet and Facebook post that message at the same time. And the hope
Oh,
is that
okay.
it gets this huge, like viral, it's like a viral explosion. So we did it and we campaigned like crazy and we had, 10 million reach lined up and all these people that we reached out to, like Norman Reedus retweeted our Kickstarter. And that was another lucky thing. I got a random, he's from it. He's in Atlanta all the time filming Walking Dead and Daryl from Walking Dead
Right.
and I got this weird whim to tweet him like, hey, we're a local indie game from Atlanta, check it out, and like send him a link and he instantly retweeted it and that I've never seen social media go crazy like that ever in my entire life. It was just like thousands of notifications, but out of all of that, we got one Kickstarter backer from it, just one. And Thunderclap, we got just one Kickstarter backer from it. And we went to Epic headquarters, they're makers of Unreal Engine. We were the first indie game that they interviewed, like on there. They had a kind of a live Twitch show that they were starting for Unreal Engine 4. So we adopted it the day it came out. We were on UDK. It came out, I'm like, we're moving. It makes sense. We're not going to finish the game in the next 2 years. So let's get on an engine that's marketable.
Right.
And that's been an awesome change. That was a good decision. And they were super supportive and brought us on, and that was like one backer. Just everything we did, and we sent all these press emails, and not a single response. And it was halfway through the Kickstarter, we kind of knew, like, oh, we're not even halfway to our goal. I don't think it's going to make it. And I mentally prepared for that, but once reality set in that it didn't go through. And pretty much everything we raised was us hand messaging like our entire Facebook friends list.
Right.
It was just kind of like the team handled it way better than I did. They were just like, oh yeah, whatever. It happens. It's cool. Let's just keep going. But I think I took almost like a 4 or 5 month break from the game. I didn't work on it at all, which is, I'm the lead of the project. If I'm not working on it, usually the team kind of starts fading a little bit too, because we build off of each other. It require every The more that everyone's doing, like, it inspires us all to keep going. It's kind of accountability built in. We have a team meeting and, hey, what'd you do this week? Oh, sweet, look at this animation. And oh my god, that building looks great. And oh
Right.
cool, you got like all you got the old the new ultimate is in or whatever. So it's like, we get it, the more everyone does, the faster the cart's moving forward, kind of things. But it was like the opposite. It was like, absolute zero for the project for a while. And then there was kind of, after that, there was a local kind of gaming and entertainment convention, and that happens here every year, and they do an investment conference, and they had invited us to pitch because they're like, hey, we know this game's been around for years, why don't you guys pitch it? So we did, and this is another eerie coincidence. It happened to be on the day my mom passed, 7 years later. I think it was 7 years, but it was on the exact day.
Right.
And we won unanimously. We practiced just for hours and went in and gave, we just poured it out there, and we won that. And it was this huge resurgence for the whole team, especially for me, because I was kind of like, is this going to make it? Should we put it back on the shelf? Because is it worth it? And yeah, it's been, 5 or 6 years of my life in my 20s and my prime trying to build something in lieu of, traveling and having fun and doing things with people that I care about, all those sacrifices, like, is it even worth it? And that kind of like just slapped all the negativity away. And it was just like, that was right when we started the Ninja, coincidentally. It was like, oh, we won the investment conference and we're starting the Ninja, like 2 months, it's done. And nothing necessarily came out of that. We met some people, but it's just like, game investments, it's a tough business.
Right.
So, it was a great, it kept the team just completely rolling on all cylinders for about 6 months. And that was really, really great for the team. It kind of bailed us out of the hole a little bit. So that's kind of, that was easiest and hardest. And then recovery from the most difficult, which brought in, ushered in the easy part.
So the day that you're finally ready to launch version 1.0, and you hit that button I always picture there's like a big red button that developers hit, the upload to Steam button. I of course I have no idea what it actually is, but that's what I always picture, like there's a, all right, in 3, 2, 1, kind of. So on that day, what do you think? Is it going to be more relief? Is it going to be more nerves? I mean, because you're in the industry anyway, and you have been for some time. I mean, but how do you think that's going to feel? I mean, I know it's a ways off, but what do you think about that day?
Yeah, every day. Because I have so many mixed feelings about the game, because it's been such a purpose and such an important part of me. Like, I feel like my whole identity is defined by Hanako, and I've spent so much of my life working on it and gave up. I've lost so many friends and relationships, and I've given up so much just to keep working on it. And my own health, just staying, getting, 3 to 5 hours of sleep a day, and just running myself ragged most of the time, just trying to handle everything that I have to do, work and Hanako and Wing Chun practice, and trying to like go to a concert once in a while and have a good time, and try to balance things. Balance is so important for anyone, even indie developers that are doing crazy hours too. But release day, it's like, as much as of a gift as Hanako is, it's such a burden too. And I don't say that to try to evoke like sympathy or pity from anyone, because it's absolutely a conscious choice. But I think it's going to be such an amazing relief. Like, I don't even think there's words for it. I think I'll probably cry an awful lot that day. Happy, happy, triumphant tears of, there's been people, so many people that are like in the industry or whatever, and it's kind of cliche, because like every like triumphant story has this part where there's the people that are like, your shit, your game sucks, and you, why are you even trying? No one ever finishes these side indie projects. And just the things I've heard over the years, just things about my art and people just being like, you don't even deserve to be in the industry. Like your art is like a coma patient and you're crap. What, your skills just keep rotting because you spend too much time on your own work. And there's just all these things that you kind of think about when you're working on these, but it's important to turn negativity into motivation, I think. And what's funny is when you said the red button thing, a sidebar for a second, our good friends in Tripwire, they're in Georgia too, Red Orchestra and Killing Floor. They actually, like, I don't know how they did it. There's a video. They actually got like a big red button, and I guess it was USB or something, and they like hooked it up to actually like launch it on Steam. They had the big like caution tape around the end and the big like lift up the glass thing to press. They actually did it for their release. It was awesome. I was like, yes, they actually did the
So
big
say it
red
sounds like
button.
something they would do.
It was fantastic. I was so happy to see that. I would love to do like if we could have some bamboo thing that's plugged in that when the circuit gets cut, it submits it so we could like cut the bamboo with a katana and like have it go live. Like, so, I don't know, some kind of thing. But what I'd love to do is just have there's two of my co-founders. They've been with us the entire project. Like, one of my classmates and then another guy we met at Georgia Tech, right? They've been on the project the entire time since 2008. I'd love to just, you know, we have to be in the same place, obviously. And if any of the team members can fly in or we can all meet up, something I'd like to keep it pretty relaxed and something that's just, it's about the team, celebrating the team's victory. And it's kind of more about them than me because I sure as hell couldn't ship anything close to a finished game without them. And there's guys on the team, I try to tell them as much as I can, like, you are the driving force behind this project. Like, I couldn't do any of this. You're pushing the cart, and I'm just trying to keep up with you. And there's such amazing talent. I think celebrating them is really important for release. But also, like, I feel like it's a new chapter. It's like there's so many travel plans and things I want to do with my girlfriend that she's like, all right, I'll endure this year or two or whatever of you going instead of like spending time with me during the week, like coming up and working on this dream of yours. Finally, I feel like I'll finally have time to breathe and be like, if I want to, I would love to take a team trip to Japan. It'd be awesome if Hanako was a huge hit. I could be like, team, we're going to Japan. We all worked hard for a lot many years for no money. Well, we're going to Japan. That would be really great. I've never been. I've never got to travel really. So it'd be awesome to take some time off and go to like Italy and Japan and climb some mountains. Not like killer ones, like, you know, go be an ice block on Everest somewhere. But yeah, release
Doable
is like,
mountains, yeah.
yeah, you know, just, you know, 10,000, not even 10,000, maybe 10,000 feet. We could just keep it nice and relaxed. But yeah, release is like, I think about it probably, it's like an all-encompassing, preoccupying thought. And it not so much for the, because the project, it doesn't, I've always said it doesn't really matter if it makes any money or not. I just want it to inspire people. And in a way, it's kind of already done that. Just from like doing Twitch streams, and I'll stream development, or someone on the team will stream development, and the people that come in and ask questions, and the next thing you know, they've watched like 200 hours of you making rocks or making whatever the things are, and they're vested and they feel part of that family, and it's created our community and their friends. And I talk to them about football and sports and life and other things, and it's like people that came into a Twitch stream. And so it's kind of mission accomplished from that standpoint, but I'd love to be able to give the team their fair share, to release it, have it do well, to where it's like you guys worked so hard for so many years for no actual guarantee of anything that now I can give you this. I can give you
Right.
what you deserve. And being able to like proverbially like hand a check to everyone on the team would be so amazing for them. And that's important to me. You know, not so much that, yeah, I mean it to become the next whatever and open up a $1 million studio after, you know, it's cart before the horse. I have no idea what the game's gonna do. It's terrifying because for so long there's like not really a whole lot of melee games. Now it's like you have this Mega For Honor game coming out this year, and I think another Chivalry's coming out. We've never had to face like direct kind of competition, and not that I think indie games have to position themselves like, hey, we can't. 10 people with no money cannot compete with 400 people with like $100 million. The math doesn't work.
Right, exactly. Well,
So.
if people want to help you see this dream through, if they want to support the game, or if they just want to get more information about the game, where should they go? How can they assist you?
I think our website, hanukogame.com, there's an early access sign up, and it's a mailing list too, where we send updates and just social networks. We our Facebook and Twitter, our Twitch streams, like it keeps there's so many nights where I'm exhausted, and if people come on Twitch when I'm working on stuff and they're just chatting and asking questions, it keeps me motivated, and I get so much done those nights. It's awesome to kind of work off of chat and the community, people coming in and buying into the project. Just anywhere support can pop up, a follow on Facebook or Twitter, or joining the early access list, because I'm pulling testers in all the time, because we've invited, I think we have 60 people in our test group, but I think maybe like 6 to 10 will show up. Like our game's designed for 16 versus 16. We want to see that in practice and make sure it works. So just expanding our closed beta group, or well, it's really technically closed alpha. It's not that polished yet. Early access will pretty much be open beta in essence. But I think any am I gonna is this the shameless plug portion for me to give the Facebook URLs?
You can absolutely do that, and I'll put them up too.
Okay. Our Facebook is Play Hanukkah. As is our Twitter is also at Play Hanukkah. And our Twitch is twitch.tv/HanukkahGame.
Well, that,
And
oh, yeah,
but
okay.
I think that's all of them. We're launching a new website, and our early access trailer is coming out in either March or April. And that's like when we're putting all of our marbles on the table. We're big press release, and let's knock down the wall to the press and finally try to get some attention and put all the resources we have forward kind of all at once, and it's do or die time coming up. So, and then it's hopefully that'll fuel us into early access, which we're aiming for October 9th, which will be 10 years to the day that my mom passed. So we'd like to stick to the theme of having things happen on important days in personal history. So
Right.
that's what we're aiming for this year.
Well, Matt, like I said, I know you're very busy and very tired, so I just want to take a second to thank you so much for coming on talking to me about Hanukkah this evening, and I wish you guys the best of luck. I can't wait to try it myself, and I said continued good luck and continued serendipity along the way, and I would love to be able to have you back on as you get closer to launch to say how the game has even progressed since now.
Oh, of course. Jeff, it's been an honor talking to you. And thanks for taking time out of your night to talk with me too. And you're welcome anytime. You're part of our family now. So hope to see you in tests, and let me know what you think.
Will do. Thank you again so much, Matt. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Have an awesome night.